It's been 5 years since I've had a raise in pay. Way things are going, I could get laid off any day. Sure is hard living with all this pain. I know what I need. I need somebody to blame. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
My neighborhood library is about to close. The school my kids go to is becoming a joke. Self-serving liberals blame it on corporate tax breaks. But that's propaganda. I know who I should hate. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
Who's to blame for the potholes and flooding and drought?
It's all their fault. It's all their fault.
Who's to blame for inflation, unemployment, and everything I'm pissed off about? Who's to blame for the end of the good old days? Who's to blame for the fact that I can't get laid? Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. In this program, journalist Matt Taibbi tells us about a huge and growing divide in the U.S. justice system. Matt visits issues of big money buying innocence and poverty often resulting in guilt. In an age of great inequality, our rule of law has been subverted. Divided into two tiers, free passes for the rich, criminalization for the poor. And then after that, who's poor? According to the U.S. government, there are 46.5 million Americans who live below the poverty line officially, but everyone who's studied poverty agrees that the way we arrive at this figure is completely wrong. Why still measure poverty in a way that so many people agree is wrong, and how could we do better?
I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Life isn't fair. No news there. But this country has always stood out as a place that was, well, pretty fair. Americans have prided themselves, or sought to, especially on fairness in the rule of law. Fairness, said Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, is what justice really is. Journalist Matt Taibbi says, look around. Our great age of inequality, he says, is undercutting fairness, justice itself in America. The rich walk, the poor are criminalized, he says. This hour on Point, American Justice in the Age of Inequality. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see it? A deepening double standard in American justice. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Matt Taibbi, reporter, author, muckraker. He reported on Wall Street crimes and scams for Rolling Stone magazine for about a decade. He's now joined First Look Media to start up a new digital magazine focusing on political and financial corruption. His new book is called The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Matt Taibbi, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What's your case?
Well, this book grew out of my experience covering Wall Street dating back to the crash of 2008, and I had spent a lot of time covering one caper after another where people working at major financial institutions committed fraud in the billions, and the punchline of all my stories I started to notice over time were the same. Nobody got indicted, nobody went to jail. And around the time of the Occupy protests, I decided to write a book about this. And in doing the research, I had to learn about who does go to jail in this country and for what. And I ended up with this kind of shocking contrast in how the criminal justice system works on the one side and how it doesn't work on the other. And that's what The Divide is all about. It's a catalog of how people who are very, very wealthy avoid criminal prosecution in jail, and how everybody else ends up in jail.
You write, more and more often we all make silent calculations about who is entitled to what rights and who is not. It's not as simple, you write, as saying everyone's the same under the law anymore. We all know there's another layer to it now. What's that layer, Matt?
Well, this is an observation that for me came from my time. I'm actually old enough to have gone to college in the Soviet Union. I went and studied in what was then Leningrad in 1990, and I remembered very vividly learning quickly that there were two sets of rules. There were the official laws that everybody mostly ignored, and then there was an unwritten set of rules that were the important ones. So in the morning, there would be the kids outside our dormitories who would try to trade rabbit hats and military gear for blue jeans. And a couple of times a week, those kids would get arrested because it was illegal to have foreign products and illegal to do trading of that kind. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the directors of the university would walk right past those same policemen wearing foreign suits and blue jeans, and nobody would ever say a thing. And so, you know, I learned that Soviets had internalized a set of values that certain people just don't get in trouble for certain things, and certain people do get in trouble for certain things. And I think I'm starting to recognize the same phenomenon happening now in the United States. If you think about what happened last year, for instance, with J.P. Morgan Chase, where there were $20 billion in fines levied against the company for a variety of offenses, or HSBC a couple of years ago, which paid a $1.9 billion fine for, among other things, laundering $850 million for a pair of Central and South American drug cartels. Mm-hmm. We just don't think of certain people as being the kinds of people who go to jail. We think of them as the kinds of people who pay fines and settle, whereas other people are the kinds of people who go to jail. So the ordinary street dealer who is also in the illegal narcotics game, that person goes to jail, whereas HSBC, you know, they were in the illegal drugs game as well, but those guys didn't go to jail. So I think it's kind of the same thing. It's not quite as drastic, but it's significant, I think.
You describe looking around and seeing a kind of crazy formula of poverty, crime, and prison populations that alerted you to maybe something being off kilter here.
Yes, there's a bizarre set of statistical mysteries that have been plaguing the United States for a couple of decades now. Dating back to 1990, violent crime in America has actually been dropping at a fairly rapid rate. It's 44% since 1990, according to federal statistics. But in that same time period, the prison population has more than doubled. It's gone from about 1 million people to somewhere between 2.2 and 2.3 million people. So it doesn't make sense. During the same period of time, of course, economic hardship and poverty have also risen. So this is another counterintuitive set of parameters, because you would expect that as things get harder for people, that crime would actually increase. That hasn't been the case. Crime has gone down, and yet we have more people in jail, and it's a very strange set of circumstances that doesn't make sense, according to a lot of statisticians who can't find a reason for this.
I think a lot of people who don't have your kind of gritty, skeptical view of life may look at this or be encouraged by our system to look at this and say, well, you know, the lapses at the top, they're kind of gauzy misdemeanors. We're not sure what they are. They're vague. And the crimes at the bottom are real. So, of course, there's a prison population with a lot of poor folks. And of course, it's more subtle at the top.
Well, I understand that point of view. It's not correct, but I understand it. And that mainly comes from a lack of understanding about what actually happened in the financial services sector leading up to the crash of 2008 and in the period since. But let's just take the same crime, fraud, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at people who are, you know, a single mom on welfare, and she gets caught in, let's say, an $800 welfare fraud. Maybe the state overpaid her and she forgot to pay back, or maybe she checked the wrong box in her application and said she didn't have a boyfriend who was living with her, and it turned out that a neighbor says that she did. The woman will inevitably pay 100% restitution for that fraud. Mm-hmm. She may lose custody of her children, and she may face prison time. I found women who did face prison time who were in that situation. Meanwhile, the same, you know, fraud on a much, much huger scale involving all the companies involved with the subprime mortgage fraud, which was, you know, a highly elaborate criminal scheme that was based on creating huge masses of toxic subprime loans that were of very low quality, disguising them as AAA rated securities, and then selling them off to institutional investors like pension funds. Essentially, what they were doing was selling bad securities to retired people, among other things, and ripping them off. And that was fraud too. But we wouldn't even think to take the custody of children away from the people who committed that kind of fraud, and none of them faced any jail time. And restitution in that part of the world is never 100%. If the fine is $1 billion, you can bet that the profit was $30 billion. And so it doesn't make any sense. It's completely counterintuitive. And so even when it's the same crime, we see this radical, radical difference in the approaches.
It can sound kind of like wonky policy stuff when you describe it, but it reads nothing like that in your book. I mean, this is visceral, deep injustice, as you describe it. You describe the criminalization of the poor broadly, and this kind of just broad exemption of the rich who are working the edge here. People going through the underwear drawers of people who have almost nothing and stopping at the tall iron gates of those who have everything.
Right. Yeah, no. And this gets to, you know, how you cover a story. I think when I first envisioned writing this book, I had already, again, for years been covering a lot of these stories where people committed, you know, high level white collar capers and weren't prosecuted for them. But that was mostly sort of an intellectual exercise for me. I didn't really get to see a whole lot of the victims of those schemes. Mm. And it didn't register for me on a personal level. But when one of the things you referred to there was the underwear drawer story. That was a program in San Diego where people who apply for welfare, they can be preemptively searched by the state, which claims that it has an interest in making sure that people are telling the truth about, for instance, not having a live-in boyfriend who is helping with the bills. And so they'll send an officer to a woman's house and go through their things. And I talked to this one woman who vividly described an officer reaching into her underwear drawer with a pencil end and holding up a pair of panties and saying, "Who do you need these for?" And in other words, you know, if you don't have a boyfriend, what's this for? And that's just so violative and so offensive. And then you think about, on the other hand, a bank that has taken a federal bailout, which is also a kind of welfare recipient, and we don't even have the ability to go in and look at their books, much less go through their underwear drawers. It's a stark, stark contrast, and that's when you start getting angry, you know. And I think that's where that approach came from.
You're writing or describing what you put forward as a kind of fundamental corruption going on of our justice system.
Yes, and I think it. It's less of a sort of Dr. Evil situation than maybe it sounds like at first blush. I think a lot of these things sort of started to happen organically over time. There are a number of different reasons why it evolved this way. But yes, we've got two different justice systems, one for the poor and one for the rich, and it's very, very upsetting.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes Great Speeches and Interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., and you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook.
You can say that it's about the savages. You can say you have a better way to live. You can call it manifest destiny. You can talk of all your civilization will give. You can say that we're a thing of history, and progress is the future you will bring. You can send your armies to these mountains. You can say we'll prosper beneath your king. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose. You can say you've got to stop the communists. You can say that our ideals can't succeed. You can say that competition is the only way, and a global system based on greed. You can call yourself a Democrat. You can call yourself whatever you will. You can keep on stamping out the fires you start, so you might stay on top of the hill. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose. Say that all of us are terrorists, madmen bent on destroying all that's free. You can say that we are building weapons as your bombers fly from sea to bloody sea. You can say you're with us or against us, and to die quietly is what we now must do. You can maintain your innocence. You can say that you are many as you represent the few. There will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose.
And now, back to Matt Taibbi, Tom Ashbrook, and Unfair Justice.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American justice in the great age of inequality. My guest, Matt Taibbi, says the rich get off and the poor get criminalized, locked up. His new book is The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Matt Taibbi joins us from New York. Matt, response for you online here. Here's one listener who says, in a capitalist society, it is impossible to prevent the influence of money in the justice system. Legislate all you like, but the influence of wealth is part of the fabric of our society. Kind of an argument that it was ever thus, Matt.
You know, that's an interesting argument, and of course, it's always been easier for the rich, and it's always been harder for the poor, and I would imagine that there have been upswings and downswings and peaks and valleys throughout our history, and where this problem has been worse and the problem has been better. But I would make the argument that in the last 20 to 30 years, we've seen a dramatic worsening of this problem, and that it's illustrated very starkly by three episodes. First is the savings and loan crisis, which was sort of like the subprime mortgage crisis, a vast nationwide problem involving financial fraud. But in the wake of that crisis, we had over 1,000 prosecutions, and we put over 800 people in jail. You fast forward about a decade after that to the next round of scandals, the big ones, which were the accounting scandals of the late 90s and early 2000s. Even the Bush administration rounded up the heads of companies like Tyco and Adelphia and WorldCom and Enron and Arthur Andersen. And there were high-level prosecutions of those companies. It wasn't as much as there were after the SNL crisis, but they still had them. And then fast forward to now, after the 2008 crisis, which dwarfed the other two crises in seriousness and in damage. I mean, there are some statistics that say that the fraud that caused the crash wiped out 40% of the world's wealth during that time. And how many people have been put in jail? Zero. So there's been a dramatic change, and I think it's exemplified by the kind of person who inhabits the regulatory structure now. It used to be that prosecutors were prosecutors. They went after rich and poor, black and white. There was an attitude that the law enforcement officials had that was sort of universal. And they've been replaced at the high levels, at the white collar level, by a new kind of person who comes from the corporate defense community. And they really are more deal makers than prosecutors. And that's why we're seeing more settlements.
There's been a kind of a philosophical shift that you describe here that may be behind some of this. I want to look at the bottom and the top. At the top level, you describe a young Justice Department official, I think in the Clinton administration, named mm-hmm. Eric Holder, talking mm-hmm. about we have to be careful about what he called collateral consequences if and when we set out to prosecute those of great economic weight.
Right, yes. Way back in the late 90s, then Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder in the Clinton administration wrote a memo that came to be known as affectionately as the Holder Memo. It actually was originally a sort of get tough on crime document because it gave prosecutors a number of tools they could use to go after corporate offenders. But at the bottom of it, it also laid out that collateral consequences policy. And all it really said was that if you're a prosecutor and you're targeting a big company that employs a lot of people and maybe has a lot of shareholders and you're worried about victimizing innocent people, in other words, executives who weren't part of the wrongdoing or the shareholders or members of the community that might be affected, then you can seek other forms of other remedies apart from criminal prosecutions, like fines or deferred prosecution agreements or non-prosecution agreements. And that makes sense. But the problem is that they're now applying it virtually in all cases because we have so many of these too big to fail companies now that it is difficult to envision prosecuting these firms without doing great damage to the world economy. I would argue that there are two reasons why that policy doesn't make sense now. One is that they use that excuse the first time, like they did with HSBC after they were caught laundering money for drug cartels, part of the settlement should have been you have to break up and become smaller so that next time you do this, we can put you in jail. And the other thing is that morally it just doesn't work if some people get off with fines and you consider the consequences for those. For the victims of those companies, but you don't consider the consequences for the ordinary person who gets put in jail for a lesser offense and what happens to his or her family. And I think that's a double standard, and we have to worry about it.
Worry too much about collateral consequences in the economy. It can mean a free pass for some. U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, seen as a pretty tough guy in Manhattan, but here he was with that Eric Holder, the Holder memo language, just this last January, sort of channeling that doctrine of collateral consequences, explaining why law enforcement must sometimes pull its punches when pursuing white-collar criminals.
You take into account all factors. You take into account the legitimate law enforcement need to have deterrence and to holding people accountable and to bringing money back to victims and to making sure that the punishment is proportional to what the conduct was. And when you're talking about an institution, we also have to take into account, as we're required to, potential collateral consequences.
In this short excerpt from the movie Gandhi, Mr. and Mrs. Gandhi address the people of India.
But now something worse is happening. When Gandhiji and I were growing up, women wove their own cloth. But now there are millions who have no work because those who can buy all they need from England. I say with Gandhiji, there is no beauty in the finest cloth, if it makes hunger and unhappiness.
My message to you is the message I have given to your brothers everywhere. To gain independence, we must prove worthy of it. There must be Hindu-Muslim unity always. Second, no Indian must be treated as the English treat us.
We must remove untouchability from our hearts and from our lives. Third, we must defy the British. Not with violence that will inflame their will, but with a firmness that will open their eyes. English factories make the cloth. That makes our poverty. All those who wish to make the English see, bring me the cloth from Manchester and Leeds that you wear today,
and we will light a fire that will be seen in Delhi and in London. And if, like me, you are left with only one piece of homespun, wear it with dignity.
And now for something completely different.